This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora and welcome to the Christmas edition of Garden of Sound, sponsored by miniquiz.com. It's been a bit of a year, hasn't it? Said the nation of understatement. I've interviewed some wonderful people this year, and very much on the wish list for quite some time was Greg Haver. If I mentioned artists like The Feelers, Devil Skin and Op Shop, you're some way to understanding how much amazing music he's either produced or played on. It's when we start moving into the Manics and Mel C, you realise how big time this guy is and how lucky New Zealand is to have him. Greg is so big time, however, that he chose to spend some time with me in Christchurch to talk all things music. And he had so much to say that next week you'll get an extra half a show just to cover off the bits we couldn't squeeze in today. So for your musical edification, all the way from Hay on Wye, this is the Garden of Sound interview with Greg Haver on Plains FM 96.9. Greg, can you tell me the first time music entered your head or your consciousness? At least.
I think it would have been early 70s when I was in school in Brecon in Wales, and pretty much everybody had a copy of Dark Side of the Moon, and it was like, ooh, that cover looks really good. I was really attracted to the cover of it, you know, the actual physical album sleeve with the prism and everything.
How old were you with this?
I would have been 12, maybe, 12, okay. 13.
Yeah.
I had really no upbringing in music. My mother listened to music a bit. My dad didn't. Mum was a big Tom Jones fan, big Beatles fan. Obviously, you know, this was brought up in the 60s in Wales. And I remember the first real musical memory I had was watching the Beatles play Let It Be on Top of the Pops, and my mother bemoaning the fact they all had beards. And it was like, you know, they looked, Paul used to look so lovely, and now he's got this beard. And I remember that really clearly and thinking, oh, this sounds quite nice. It's quite a cool sound, but no real awareness of music, apart from, you know, like going to church on a Sunday and all that sort of stuff. Then, yeah, so in school in Brecon, Dark Side of the Moon, and then somebody said to me, you need to buy Ziggy Stardust by David Bowie. So I had a bit of pocket money, and we were allowed out on a Tuesday afternoon, and I went up. I remember the name of it was Stardust. So I bought The Man in Black by Alvin Stardust instead of Ziggy Stardust. An album I actually still quite like, because I quite like that kind of like 70s sort of, you know, chinny chap kind of production, big glam rock production mm-hmm. thing.
Schmaltz.
Those records are great, like The Sweet and, you know, Stardust and Susie Quattro and all that stuff is really amazing kind of... productions. I often kind of gravitate to some of those ideas, but then I went back after much ridicule. I went back up the next week and I bought Ziggy Stardust, and that kind of changed my life, really, just listening to Bowie records. And so he became my kind of touchstone artist for years and years and years and years. So
Wales seems to be a country of singers, and yet you say your father wasn't really sort of into
my father's
into
a Cockney
music.
Though my father's a Londoner.
Ah,
mum's Welsh and dad's full Cockney.
So was there much sort of choral singing or maybe bands or groups at school?
In school, yeah. I mean, choir. I was in school choir. God knows why, because I'm still to this day not a great singer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was more interested in the school trips and going drinking on the school choral trips.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, sort of church music and, you know, sort of Welsh rugby songs were obviously quite big.
Cause yes.
This was the 70s. This was Gareth Edwards. This was Phil Bennett. This was the you know, JJ, JPR, all the, mm-hmm. the golden yep. age of Welsh rugby, until obviously we had Gatland for a while. But and it's all gone to shit again. But yeah, so it's very much that kind of like tradition. You know, I was brought up on the borders in a little town called Hay on Wye, which is, it's not deepest Wales. It's rural, kind mm-hmm. of almost rural Herefordshire, because it's on the border of Herefordshire and Breconshire.
Okay.
So it's not really steeped in that kind of like Welsh traditions, like the Welsh valleys would say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a weird little town because it was right on the border. And when I was growing up, Wales was dry on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. You could not buy alcohol in Wales anywhere on a Sunday. No pubs were open, nothing. but there was one pub across the little stream in England. So the whole town would gravitate to this pub on a Sunday lunchtime queue. My grandmother and my mother shouting at my father and grandfather, why aren't you back for Sunday lunch? And this was a very regular occurrence on a... So Sunday involved being with my father and grandfather drinking than ever did really doing anything in church and going choral stuff. So my dad was Roman Catholic and my mother was Church of Wales. Mm-hmm. There was no way I was going to mass. So it was like, yeah, it was quite a strange upbringing, and it wasn't very musical. I think they were very shocked when I actually decided music was something I wanted to do as a profession.
So singing not for you, but drums at some point took your fancy. Were there any other instruments aside from the drums?
I play a bit of keyboards, mm-hmm. and I'm a terrible guitarist, and I've sung a lot of backing vocals on records and everything, but you know, it's all right in a group of several yep. people, but certainly not my own.
During the breakdown, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's just gang vocals, I'm always big on gang vocals. Mainly to keep everyone else under control, because they usually those sessions fall apart with everyone laughing. So you need someone to be kind of school teacherly and hold things together. Mm. I mean, drums was like, there was a school play happening. I think it was Richard the Second, Richard the Third, one of those. They needed some kind of like military drumming kind of thing. And mm-hmm. there was a school drummer and he needed an assistant. And I just put my hand up. That literally me putting my hand up changed my whole world, really. So it was like, drums, this is great.
What compelled you to put your hand up?
I don't know. I always quite liked the fact that drums looked kind of cool on stage. And they were like, I always liked the idea of like a den. Mm-hmm. Like I'd get cardboard boxes and I'd build little dens when I was a kid.
So like a fortress.
I'm going deep into my own I'm psychoanalyzing myself here.
That's good.
And I like that with drums, you kind of do the same thing. You build this little kind of like little protective shell for yourself, uh-huh. yet you're kind of like still performing and still... So you can be an extrovert and introvert at the same time. Mm-hmm. Drums really appeal to me. And I was a big Led Zeppelin fan, and John Bonham's been my lifelong kind of hero drumming-wise. So I think I was always gravitated towards these big, loud things at the back of the stage. And I guess it totally fitted my personality type, I guess.
How did your parents feel about you taking on this considerable expense?
I was kind of lucky with Dad, because he was always going on to me about doing things I enjoyed doing. So he really loved his work, and he travelled a lot when he was, all throughout his working life, and saw a lot of the world, and really enjoyed what he was doing. And he said, whatever you do, just enjoy what you do. I guess I often think, I compare it to, the worst thing I could have done apart from leave school and join a band was become a clown and join the circus. They're kind of on a similar kind of like on a par, really, and... Yeah, they were really supportive, and I did catch a plan. How can I get Dad to buy me a drum kit? Mm. And I would just start tapping on the table at dinner and lunchtime, just being really irritating. And he succumbed in the end. Why don't you get yourself a belly set of drums? And if you buy me a set,
Do you remember what that first set of drums was? Mm. The make?
Yeah, it was 1960s Premier, mahogany finish. Which I've just sold, actually. It's been sitting in storage in the Manic Street Preachers storage room in Cardiff for about, was certainly there for the last 15 years. And they just had a big clear out, and my old business partner, Kerry Collier, he said, I've got all this gear of yours. What are we going to do with it? It's old tape machines and all this stuff. And he said, your old drum kit's here. So I thought, I didn't really want it just to sort of gather dust somewhere. I wanted someone to use it. So I just sold it to this company called Joe Cox Drums in Yorkshire, and they're going to recondition it and set it on. And I kind of quite like the idea, because vintage drums has become quite a sort of a market. I hate gear not being used. Yeah. Like, it's like seeing guitars in shrink wrap, and mm-hmm. It's like seeing a caged tiger. Yeah. That sort of instruments need to be played, and I feel guilty that kit's been sitting in gathering dust for 30 odd years, and I'd like to serve.
Was it used on any recordings?
No, I never used it. No, it was. Drum sizes used to be not standardized, so drum heads would be specific for different companies. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to get drum heads for those. So it was never like the greatest gig. I played my first gigs on it, but by the time I started recording, I'd got a Pearl, this enormous Pearl Diner family kind of like. I was in a prog rock band, mm-hmm. which is a whole other story. Massive drum, two bass drums, like 13 toms. All that sort of stuff. So yeah,
so many stories, so little time.
I've been around for a lot of years, so there's a lot of
It is time to play some music, and at this point I do ask about influences. Now, you have talked about David Bowie, and you've talked about Led Zeppelin, you've t- talked about Elvin Stardust, even.
I wouldn't
Tom
say
Jones
Elvin Stardust an influence, but yeah,
major influence in Greg's life. Yeah. Is there a track that you'd like to play for us now that has maybe influenced either your playing or your production?
Yeah, I think I picked Life on Mars. Did I pick Life on Mars?
You did.
Yes.
He says.
Yeah. I mean, how do you pick a Bowie song to? The reason I picked this one was I went to a Ken Scott evening who produced Life on Mars, and he broke down he had the original multi-tracks of it.
Wow.
It was just fascinating. And I happened to be back in Wales, and he was doing a seminar in Cardiff, and he had like some original George Harrison multi-tracks. He had all kinds. Because his first session was Magical Mystery Tour. The very first session he was thrown in on was as a young engineer was Magical Mystery Tour by the Beatles. And it was like, so he's got this incredible history of sort of stuff. And he did the Ziggy Stardust record. He did Hunky Dory. And he had the multi-tracks and he broke them down. And I remember he soloed the piano tracks. And Rick Wakeman, I believe, was playing piano on it.
True.
And as he was playing, I had two feelings. One was, wow, that piano's really out of time. And the other one was, I actually started feeling, I was starting to well up. It was like seeing a relation be disemboweled in front of you. You know, it was like seeing something being that you know so intimately being broken down.
A negative feeling.
Well, it was like, maybe that's the wrong analogy, but you know, it's kind of that, oh my God, I'm seeing like inside something that's so precious to me. Yeah, no, I really felt like I could feel myself getting really emotional. Because it was like, that was my childhood, that was my upbringing, that was the reason I got into music, and there it was being pulled apart in front of my eyes or in front of my ears, and it was, it was just as magical, sort of, and all the stories behind, like the, at the end, there's that kind of like, there's all these weird sound effects at the end, and what it was, there's a telephone in the recording studio, and the phone rang right at the end of I think the piano take or one of Bowie's takes, and it went over and answered it. And it's all actually on. If you listen to the end of it, that's what the sound effect is at the end. It just happened to be a phone. Who puts a phone in a recording studio on the studio floor? So, yeah. So that's for a multitude of reasons. And I had to pick one song. It's because I feel I know that song more intimately than all the others.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for, for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Is there life on Mars? It's on America's tortured brow. Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clown. But the film is a sad thing for, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be writ again, as I ask you to focus on sailors
This is the Garden of Sound interview with Greg Haver on Plains FM 96.9.
So, I left school to join a band, mm-hmm. right? I waited till my father was away in the Middle East working to tell him that I'd given up my expensive public school education to join a band. I was in this prog rock band called Retreat from Moscow, and we were proper prog, mellotrons, double neck guitars, massive drum kits. This was in kind of like new wave post-punk territory.
Okay.
So we were pariahs.
Like, yeah.
As a review said at the time, which we always like to quote to ourselves now, we're old men, if you don't like Retreat from Moscow, I bet your girlfriend does.
So challenge.
It's, yeah, so it was... but we were proper prog, and we were together from like 79 to 82, I believe it was, and we did one single. I think 10 years after that, we did a sort of... I think at our guitarist kind of like, I don't know, whatever birthday it was, we played some of the old songs and... And that was 88, I think it was. And then just before I moved to New Zealand, it's like, let's get together for a curry and have some drinks and catch up on old times and everything. So a couple of wines in, I decided to say, do you know what? When I come back, we should record some songs because we haven't really got any recordings because all our stuff was done onto cassette. They're about fifth generation copies.
Yep.
It all sounds like crap.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's do that. And of course, I started getting emails. When are you coming back? When can we do these songs? So I was at Rockfield Studios in Wales recording a band called Chinaski, a Czech band. The guys are going for a photo shoot all morning. Do you want to come down? We'll have a jam. So the guys came down, and we hadn't, this was in 2016, and we hadn't played together since that 1988 or 89, that show. And we just started playing these old songs, and it was like, it was so ingrained in our long-term memories. It was like we hadn't stopped playing together.
Yeah.
It was so weird. And so we played through the songs, and it's like, and then a few weeks later, we went into to another studio and we recorded just over a weekend, which we'll bang some songs out just for a laugh, you know, just for our own personal things. And we kind of really enjoyed it. And it's like, next time I'm back, should we just do a couple more songs? So this went on for 4 years of doing a couple more. So we ended up with a whole album of like an hour and a quarter as long. Two-thirds of the songs are songs you wrote as teenagers.
Yeah.
The other third are new songs. And now we've got a record deal for it with a prog rock label in the UK. We've got a launch gig planned for... Well, it was going to be last August. It's now planned for next August.
Yeah.
And we've decided to do three albums for this label. So we plan to go to the Czech Republic and record an album towards the end of next year, COVID permitting kind of thing. But it's the same lineup. So basically, songs we wrote as teenagers... We're now playing, I'm the baby of the band at 59. It's like we'll all be in our 60s by the time we do the gig. Sort of like bookended our lives with this one particular band.
How does the new stuff compare to the old stuff in terms of style?
Well, I mean, lyrically it's quite different because, you know, your worldview as a young man is very different to your worldview as an older person. So it's like, but musically it's actually, we're all much better musicians. So it's like, so we're able to play things that are a lot more complicated than we could play when we were. So there's lots of odd time signatures. There's lots of, and also we have the resources to do what we want to do. So let's put strings on this. Let's do this. You know, let's push the boat out. I didn't want to produce it as well because we always produced as a band with an engineer when we were younger.
Yeah.
So I brought Clint Murphy in, who's engineered for me for years.
Yes.
And Kiwi, who we swapped countries and we've worked together for 15 years.
Yeah.
So like you can co-produce it with us. And I will just be part of the band kind of thing. So that was quite fun as well. So I could just play and step back. And so it's been really, you know, we had a rehearsal in Cardiff just before COVID, ready for the gig that never happened in August. And it was actually quite emotional. You know, you're playing these songs that, you know, you have they're really a big part of your life. Yeah, it's just nice to hang with them, you know, and sort of like reminisce on all the crazy stuff we did as young people. And
what's your connection to Czech Republic?
I did an album for an artist called Peter Aristone, 2014, 2015. So I started working a lot for his label, the label that he was on, a company called Brainzone, who were big promoters and label. They were kind of a well-funded startup, and now they've become like the most successful label in the country. And there was a band called Chinaski who, they've been together for 20 years, and they left Universal and signed to Brainzone, and they asked if I would go and do a couple of songs for their greatest hits record. I'd never heard of them before, and they were doing a greatest hits album, and they'd been together 20 years. So we did a couple of songs for it, and their previous few albums hadn't done very well. They were a bit undercooked. They were not great records, but they're a really good band. They played together for so long. Put them in a room together, and they play, and they just sound incredible.
Yeah.
So it's like, we could do something real serious damage with this if we really put our minds to it. So we did these couple of singles, and then we went to Rockfield Studios in Wales. They'd never recorded outside of the Czech Republic before.
Yeah.
And they wanted to go somewhere iconic. And there's a few Queen fans in the band, and Bohemian Rhapsody and Night of the Opera were done at Rockfield. I said, well, let's go to Rockfield and record the album. So we went there for a couple of weeks. It was amazing because it was just like that studio was so iconic. And it's, you know, all the great stories about the Oasis stories and Rush and Queen. And Chris Martin wrote Yellow, sitting outside looking at the stars from the bench outside, because it's like this courtyard. Yeah. Stone Roses burnt their hire car in the middle of the courtyard. Noel attacked Liam with a cricket bat there. You know, there's all these, you know, all these great rock and roll stories. And we went there, and that, they actually ended up calling the album Rockfield with the permission of the studio. One of the cows from the farm is on the album cover. And this cow became quite a legendary character in the Czech Republic. Like, who was this cow? You know, and so there were press stories about the Rockfield cow and everything. I'd go and watch them in Prague, and they'd play to 18,000 people in arenas, you know. So it was, I did a good 5-6 year stint, but I've done that a lot. It happened to me in New Zealand. I'd come here to do a record. It would do well. I did the Feeders Playground Battle record. It did well. I kept coming back, did the Op Shop record. The same things happened to me in sort of Ireland and Switzerland and Greece as well. It's sort of, you know, you go to all these countries and you find these artists that are really huge in their own territories.
Yeah.
And you develop all these little micro careers everywhere, and it's quite fascinating, and I love traveling. Yeah. Traveling is one of my favorite things to do. So, you know, I do seek out kind of weird places to go as well. Where am I going to record next? Like, I was in Norway recording last year. I was like, Norway, right, how far north can I get? So I did World's Most Northerly Town in Google, and Longyearbyen in Svalbard came up. So I went up to Svalbard and went out in the Arctic and did all this crazy shit. And I was in Riga the year before, and I went over to Moscow and St. Petersburg. So just... Yeah, I think I take after my dad's kind of like travel gene when he was in the 1950s. He'd go to Africa to work. I found a big box of photographs before his funeral. My stepmother gave me this big box of photographs, and I found these pictures of him standing next to the Sphinx. I never knew he'd been to Egypt, you know, pictures of him by the Aswan Dam and all over Uganda and all over Africa. And it's like beautifully shot on black and white film, and it's like, wow, he looked like some sort of movie star.
And you never spoke about his travels?
Yeah, well, we did a little bit. He told me the great story about how he was doing a hydro project by Lake Victoria, and there was one hotel there, and staying at the hotel was Humphrey Bogart, Laura Bacall, Catherine Hepburn. They were filming The African Queen, so he would sit in the bar with Humphrey Bogart and have a whiskey and a cigarette, and it felt so glamorous and so Hollywood and sort of, yeah.
Which is pretty much what you've been doing, hobnobbing with all these big
names
across the years.
I think there are definite parallels. When I look back, there are definite parallels between his intrepidness and my desire just to jump on planes and go places. But for him, you know, it's a 7-day trip to Africa by flying boat. For me, it's like... You know, so it's he was definitely much more intrepid than me. And, you know, I always remember as a child being dressing up to fly. You'd put your best clothes on.
Absolutely.
You know, your best Sunday best, and you go and fly.
Proper cutlery as well.
Yeah, and goodness knows what's going to be like in the future. Maybe it'll go back to that. But, you know, it's pretty much everyone wearing their pajamas now. Yeah, it was like my mother would have been mortified if I'd have not been in my Sunday best flying to Spain or something.
Talking about flying around the world and performing for people, you've talked about playing with Mannix and doing percussion and things like that. You've also played on James Dean Bradfield's, some of his recordings.
I did a solo record, Well, I did 10 years with the Mannix.
Mm.
Right through from, I engineered some of This Is My Truth album.
Yes.
I produced a couple of tracks on I Know Your Enemy. Then I produced most of Lifeblood. I did like 7 tracks. Tony Visconti did 3, I believe. And which was cool because going back to the Bowie thing, I spent some time with Tony Visconti in New York working on some songs for the record. When all we really did was I asked Tony Visconti questions constantly for 3 days about every record he'd made that I grew up with, all those Bowie records.
Reasonable.
And he was really generous with his time, and it was an amazing experience for me to spend time with him because he was a major reason for me being a musician. And in the meantime, I did Nick's solo album, I Killed the Zeitgeist, and I played drums on James' solo record and produced a few tracks for that. So it was a really long-term kind of, you know, relationship, and it was definitely a lot of work I've got over the years because of my relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
But playing on James's record was a lot of fun because it would just be me and him doing sort of, we just sit in the room, we jam, we play some Led Zeppelin songs, and then we'd said, right, got this idea, and we play through it. Because Sean from the Manics never really liked doing things outside of the band. So often if James would get asked to do something, he'd give me the call to come and play drums on it. And which included, much going back to what I was saying earlier, playing on a Tom Jones record, which is my mother's greatest, all she ever wanted me to do was play on a Tom Jones record because she loved Tom and still to this day loves Tom. And he's Welsh, he's the King of Wales, essentially. Yes. So yeah, we did an Elvis Presley cover, and we're at Rack Studios, and myself and James and Tom, and yeah, so that was pretty cool. And I think the album sold 7 million copies or something.
Wow.
So it was Duet's album he did called Reload.
Yeah.
So that was kind of cool. And my mother's greatest moment in my career was me doing that record.
Is there a song from that James Dean Bradfield
album? Yeah, No Way to Tell a Lie. If I had to pick one performance as a musician, the drumming for me on that record is just like, it's quite tricksy because I don't know what time it's interesting. I'm not going to fall into that trap again. It's not in 4. It's quite tricky, but it sounds just, all the choices I made on the performance of it are great, and he really brings the best out of you as a musician. He's got this incredible way of just getting you, really pushing you to get the best out of you. And I remember my then girlfriend, my now wife, listened to it, and she was like so excited by my playing on it. I think it fed into me getting a wife. So I think so she's, oh man, your drumming's so hot on that record. I'm like, oh man, yeah, I'm definitely in here. And it's like, so I think that I always listen to it. I'm like, you know, I think, and I tell James this, you know, I think a really big part of me marrying Jackie was because of my playing on that record. So it wasn't just the drumming. It was like everything associated with it. So, yeah. I hear you got some love to give away, but maybe it never belongs. I think I've seen this somewhere before.
This is the Garden of Sound interview with Greg Haver on Plains FM 96.9. Greg, I want to ask, you've worked with a whole heap of people across your career. This is slightly morbid. Is there anyone who's passed away that you wish you could have worked with?
Yeah, or Bowie, obviously. That would have been. Although, would I have been too intimidated to do that? I don't know. It's like, although I found that, you know, you meet people that you really admire and you realize are just musicians doing their thing.
Yep.
They just do, they have the say. Well, actually, they have even more pressures than normal musicians do. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I did an album, God, 2005, 2006 with Melanie C from
yes.
Spice Girls.
Yep.
And just seeing a glimpse into her world was, I don't know how you can live like that. It's like the constant inability to go anywhere without being the center of attention. You know, we'd record in the week and she had a place in Wales at the time, which is actually coincidental. That wasn't how I got the job.
Mm.
But she had a sort of a place near Monmouth and she would like often, oh, do you want me to drive you back? So you know, we'd go back in her car and we'd stop off at service stations and it would cause utter mayhem. And I remember shopping in Tesco's in Cardiff at midnight on a Friday night. And it's like people, obviously that can't be Melanie C from the Spice Girls shopping in Tesco's in Cardiff. And the moment she would speak, everyone realized it was her and it was everyone. It would just be mayhem, you know? And she'd tell me all these stories about, you know, the pressures of when she was in the band and, you know, sort of like just, and how it affected her emotionally and sort of, I was like, man, how does she deal with that? It's like, she just wants to be a musician making music. She's one of the most professional musicians I ever worked with. She'd always come in on her A game all the time, you know? And it was like, and was really good to myself and Clint. She just looked after us really well and made sure we were, you know, we were taken care of. And she'd drop food parcels off at our accommodation in the mornings, you know, organic vegetables and make sure we're eating properly and all that stuff. I really admire musicians who have to deal with that level of, you know, sort of recognition. Because it's hard enough being a musician as it is, and then you pile that on top of it as well. It's a really kind of interesting glimpse into the sort of the surrealness of success. What was the question again? Oh, somebody passed away.
Indeed, you said Bowie at least.
Yeah, obviously, but I don't know. It's like there's a couple of bands I'd love to. I'd love to do a Mogwai record because I love them as a band. I'd love to do an instrumental record. Like a Sigur Rós record or something, you know, where vocals aren't the important part of it. And I did a few instrumentals with the Manics,
mm-hmm.
and they were always really good fun to do because you had so much freedom to do whatever you wanted.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think my desires have moved in such a different way in the last few years that I leave the production to the young guys. And people want to work with me, that's great. I don't go out and pitch for jobs anymore. I don't seek work to do. If someone asks me and I think it'll be fun, you know, and I try to keep it varied, like obviously I've just finished a country record with Miranda. I did the last Devil Skin album.
Yes.
Which is like the heaviest record
different.
I've done for, you know. The processes are very similar.
Yeah.
It's musicians playing in a room, you know. I've done enough metal records to have a really good understanding of what is expected. But really for them, what I was trying to capture was they sound really great in a rehearsal room.
Yeah.
You know, they have that really, and Jenny has this incredible kind of like, apart from her vocal being amazing, she has this incredible energy when she performs, even in a rehearsal room. So I actually switched a lot of the way we did vocals in the studio to give her a hand mic. So she was just running around the room with a hand mic, you know, to try and recapture a lot of that energy.
You're like the river and cut through the stone. Fight like a lion, defending his home. Be like the river and cut through the bone. Oh, never afraid that you're ever.
We really went to the weeds. Like we got 8 Marshalls. Just try every single combination of every amp and every speaker till we found the
sounds ultimate, old school.
The ultimate guitar sound. So we spent a lot of the first few single sessions for that album just finding the best combinations of snare drums,
yep.
guitar amps, speakers, you know. And then so we had a really good template for the record.
And that stuff still happens in this day and age. There is the budget to.
Of all the New Zealand artists, they probably shift more merch than any artist in New Zealand.
Yeah.
you know, and they're a really well-run band, you know, financially, and, you know, they work really hard.
Yep.
I'm always conscious of New Zealand budgets not being, you know, as big as European budgets, say, but we had a really good team when that was myself and Simon Gooding. Simon had just come off the Alien Weaponry record. Simon is kind of a bit too big to be engineering a record these days, but we have a long relationship going back like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we enjoy working together. So it's, it was kind of like the A team, really. It was really, and we just holed up in the brick room downstairs at Roundhead for like about 3 weeks and did the whole thing.
How's that record done?
Really good. Yeah, it was number one record, you know. So it's like sold a lot of records. It's they love it, which is the main thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was certainly doing another record when if they wanted me to, because it was really, it was a lot of fun. It was not what you people would think on the outside looking in. Like 4:30 every afternoon, we have tea and biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's sitting around with the big red beards drinking tea, you know. There's no bottles of Jack Daniels. Although we did have, we did record Paul's motorbike out in the garage at Roundhead. We kind of sort of like put some mics in there and revved up the motorbike. And one of the intros, one of the songs is the motorbike revving up. And then I went out, went to leave the studio, and like there was like exhaust fumes all the way through the building.
Mm.
So that was a little bit rock and roll, but yeah, it was fun. But I like that variation of production. It's like, why not do a metal record and why not do a country record? Because, you know, I like that. I've always enjoyed that real variation of kind of skill sets and not beholden to one. I mean, look at Rick Rubin. Look how, I am not Rick Rubin by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, you can do a Black Sabbath album and a Johnny Cash record and a Dixie Chicks album. You know, it's just, it's about the choice of songs. It's about the structure of the songs. It's about delegation of personnel, which is something I'm really big on, bringing really good people in to do things, and finding the right mix engineers, finding the right sort of right personnel for the record. So,
Would you be the person to suggest a change of direction for a band? Let's say for the second Devil Skin record, we could hit more people by doing this.
I could do, but I really like the artist to drive what they want. I've always been really conscious of not being that producer that comes in and goes, you know, we could sell a load more records if we did this. You know, it's just like, what record do you want to make? Let's figure out a way to do that. I try to shield the artist from pressures from management, labels, publishers, who are always, they all want commercial success.
Okay.
But the artists, yes, they want commercial success, but they don't want to compromise their art to a point. I think with the Devil's Skin record, I wanted to give them back control of that choice of songs and what they were doing. And there were some songs that hadn't made other records they really wanted to record, and we did some of those on there. Recording's never a smooth, easy process, but I mean, that went pretty well. And when you've got a singer like Jen, you can kind of like, so many records that you do are saved by an amazing vocal, but so many records that sound amazing are kind of made a little bit average by a not a great vocal. You know, it's just one of those truisms about recording. If you get a great singer, you can get away with a lot. I had a really interesting conversation at the Producer Series last year. We had a little sort of public seminar with myself, Joel Little, and Mark Rankin. Mark, who was Paul Epworth's engineer for a long time. He produced Queens of the Stone Age. And it was a really interesting chat because Mark and Joel know each other, because Mark's mixed a lot of stuff for Joel. And Mark was telling this great story about Rolling in the Deep. And he was on the writing session with Paul Epworth and Adele, just the three of them in a room, a little tiny room in London, and like stamping on the floor for drums, acoustic guitar, you know. And so they're writing, and Adele's sitting there with a dog on her lap. And she said, I think I've got an idea for a vocal. She's written some lyrics out. She's dog sitting on her lap, pulls this like cheap Rode mic across, sings this vocal, right?
Could have had it all in the deep. You have my heart inside your head, but you played it with a beating.
It's like, cool. Wow, that is really good. So she went to LA to record with like Rick Rubin and a load of, you know, Pino Palladino and a lot of great session guys, and they re-recorded Rolling in the Deep. And she was like, I prefer the original version that we did. So they basically took the original version they did in the writing room, added some drums, you know, tarted up a few things, but the vocal on Rolling in the Deep is the one with her with the dog on her lap into a Rode mic. So it's always about the moment. Then Joel pointed out, oh, we used like a cheap Rode mic for Royals as well. It's like, so like, look, here's an example to all of you engineers and producers in the room, in the seminar. It's like, it's not about the expensive microphone. It's not about the gear. It's about the performer. It's about the moment. It's about all these things. Like, so here are two massive records, two of the biggest records in the world in their time that were done on a cheap Rode microphone. You got to really drill down into what the process is about. And it's not about the best bit of gear. It's not about sort of like the best studios. It's just about, you know, where are you in that sort of moment? And you can have the best musicians in the world. Doesn't make the song any better. It's a fine lesson to learn for young producers. It's why I do those seminars, because even I was surprised by that moment. It's like, really? A dog on her lap? And that vocal just sounds like it's, she just performs the shit out of that vocal.
She is a stunning talent.
Yeah, yeah. And as a producer, when you work with really talented people, it's really easy because they make you sound amazing. Like when James Bradfield from The Manics sings a song, you were like, holy shit, really? Firstly, you're like constantly cranking the gain down because his voice is so loud.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, all the vocals on the Lifeblood record were done with a Shure SM58 with him sitting in the control room with a cigarette in one hand and a vocal. All the backing vocals, all the lead vocals on the songs that I produce were all done with an SM58 in the control room with no headphone speakers and on it all the time. And it's like, no one believes me, but it's actually true. It's like, and it's quite a crafted record. It's not like a sort of, you know, garage rock record. It's a really kind of pristine, he just really wanted to do something different. And it wasn't even a better one or anything. It was just a shitty SM58 that was in the studio. And that was the one he used for the whole record. And
amazing.
The only difference between doing lead vocals where he'd sat this couch at the back of the room and the backing vocals, he'd sit in the doorway so he could smoke a cigarette whilst doing the backing vocals. It was their studio, so they were allowed to smoke in it. But it was in the cell, had another set, which is the whole other set of problems. You end up feeling like you're smoking 20 cigarettes a day. Performance and ability, just like, you know, you are blessed as a producer when you work with amazing people who just deliver when they go in, you know, and it's like, it's a real privilege to be in the room with people like that.
Looking back, is there any time you've really got it wrong?
So many times. So, but that's how you learn. You know, I often recount the story when I was in Visa Lord Studios in Hilversum in Holland. One of the first jobs I did from my manager, Stephen Budd, and we had a very difficult client, and I felt I had the ability to handle it, you know. And then very early in the session, I realized that the pressure was just insane, and the band wanted to do one sort of record, the label and the manager wanted to do another sort of record, and there was a moment, one morning. It really got to me, and we were working insane hours every day. And the only way I could deal with it was to curl up in the fetal position in the drum booth and cry like a baby. And it was like just to get something out. It's like some sort of catharsis, so I could get something out of my system because I was so like stressed out by the whole thing. And we never finished that record. We had to actually get the tapes and do it. Me and my engineer Steve do a midnight flit, get on a plane, get the hell out of Dodge. I've still got all the tapes. I learned a lot from that session, like. Listen to my manager because he said it would be difficult, and also just you learn when things go wrong. You learn a lot. You don't want things to go wrong. I mean, when I look back on it, certainly thousands of records I've made is a really small percentage of records that have gone wrong. But every so often, you just for whatever reason, you know, it could be outside pressures, it could be just a clash of personalities, it could be you can't get through a whole career. Even the greatest producers I know, they've all had bad sessions, you know. Yeah. And you live with it and you learn from it.
This is the Garden of Sound interview with Greg Haver on Plains FM 96.9. Greg, I'm very excited to present Mini Quiz to you.
God.
It's the Christmas edition, which is fantastic, being Christmas Day today, unless you're listening to this after the fact. You're going to have 1 minute to answer 10 questions. If you don't know the answer, just pass.
Like Mastermind, essentially.
Yes, very similar to Mastermind, okay, except nowhere near as brainy.
I would hope not.
Oh, and you're only trying to beat five. Five is the highest anyone has scored thus far.
Right.
So you should do pretty well. Greg Haver, your mini quiz starts. Austrian Catholic priest Joseph Mohr is famous for providing the words to which Christmas carol?
Silent Night.
In the New Zealand version of 12 Days of Christmas, what type of bird would we find in the punga tree?
Pass.
What was the name given to the various artists who recorded Do They Know It's Christmas in 1984?
Band-Aid.
What were the boys of the NYPD choir singing?
Galway Bay.
What band had a huge Christmas hit with Merry Christmas, Everybody?
Slade.
Which famous musician died on Christmas Day 2016?
Oh, God, I should know this. Can't remember. Pass.
Which musician sang All I Want for Christmas Is You?
Shakin' Stevens?
Who duetted with David Bowie on Little Drummer Boy in 1976?
Bing Crosby.
Who was driving home for Christmas in 1986?
Chris Rea, maybe?
Your time has stopped. I'm just going to ask the last question here. You're not going to get any points for it. All right. I'm going to ask you anyway. Who was Snoopy's adversary in the Royal Guardsman's song Snoopy's Christmas?
Was it the Red Baron, maybe?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, I think you've done tremendously well. Right, Silent Night. It was a pukeko in the punga tree.
Yeah, I'm a Welshman. You have to remember that.
Indeed, I do. I put that in just to keep it Kiwi. Band-Aid, congratulations. Galway Bay, Slade. Christmas Day 2016 was George Michael.
George Michael, oh God, yeah.
All I Want for Christmas Is You, Mariah Carey.
Right, yes.
Possibly there was a version, but judge's decision is final. Yeah. Bing Crosby, amazing version with David Bowie.
It's actually one of my, I think it is my favourite Christmas song.
Yeah.
When Bowie comes in, I'm your new neighbour. And it's a great moment. It's like so contrived, but so beautiful as well. Yeah. It might even beat The Pogues as my favourite Christmas song.
Indeed.
What's our score?
Funnily enough, we're not quite there yet. I will just say on The Pogues, Shane McGowan, born on Christmas Day,
all right.
1957.
Amazing. Did a big hoo-ha at the BBC because they've edited, they've done a sense of the song.
Indeed.
It's like, just leave it. Just leave it.
Just leave it as it is. Yes, Chris Rea, Driving Home for Christmas, and we ran out of time for the Red Baron.
Not that I'm competitive or anything.
No, Greg Haver right to the top of the leaderboard. You overachieving so-and-so. What's next? What's coming up? 2021.
There's some things I can't talk about that I'm trying to achieve. One thing I really want to do is try and enact some of the things that are in the Music Commission report that I'm working on, which is this Swedish New Zealand comparisons. And so I should have the report finished by the end of February. Then it's just I'd hate the idea of it sitting on a desk somewhere. So I will be bending lots of ears to try and sort of like, you know, there's a lot of things in there about music education. There's a lot of stuff in there about sort of, grassroots support for musicians and things. So I'd like to take some time away from the studio to work on that. The music industry in New Zealand is growing at an exponential rate. The production sector is really building. The artist sector is really building. There's lots of new programs. The other thing I set up I didn't mention was the new music development program with NZ On Air, which is grants for producers to do artist development so they can take time out of their earning schedule to spend time with new artists to develop them as artists sonically and musically and write songs. And so that's been a really big program we've worked on this year with myself and David Riddler and Ash Wallace at NZNA. So, follow some through some of those programs and try to build the production sector. So a lot of it is how to, look at a 15, 20 year plan for the New Zealand music industry. So we can become a net exporter of music because we're well on the way to doing it. And the skill base within musicians and within the music industry here is really high. So that feels like a really, good thing. Hopefully I can get back to Europe and do the Retreat from Moscow album launch and we can finish our second album. That would be good. Just enjoy being in New Zealand and enjoy being alive. I've had a really, really blessed existence. It's like I've had most of my career working in things that I love doing. I'm just insanely lucky. So I'd like to travel a bit more. I just started traveling a lot and going to places that I really wanted to go. So I had all kinds of plans this year. I was going to go to Pyongyang. I was going to go to Ushuaia in South America. And, I've got a whole lot of places, crazy places that I could never drag my wife to that are too cold.
Yeah.
And then we'll meet up somewhere nice and warm where we can sit and drink wine and talk about things and go to see art galleries and stuff. I have a blessed existence. So it's like I'll just carry on doing kind of what I do. But supporting producers, artists and musicians in New Zealand is a really big part of what I want to do for the next 5-10 years.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's just been a very pleasant Sunday morning in a Christmas Day morning. If anybody genuinely thinks we're recording this on Christmas Day, they're delusional.
Let's hope nothing bad has happened between now and
yes,
and then.
Let's hope not. Yeah.
There you go. Merry Christmas.
Thanks very much. Same to you.
That was Miranda Easton with O Holy Night. Greg has been working with Miranda on her new album, and I believe that'll be out sometime in early 2021. Next week, you'll get a second helping of Greg's interview with some of my fave tracks of 2020. You can find out more about Greg by heading to gardenofsound.nz and clicking on his image on the homepage. Thanks so much to MiniQuiz.com for sponsoring the show. This has been Garden of Sound, and I welcome you back next week. In the meantime, keep well, keep listening, and keep playing. Mere kirihmete, and a happy new year. Haere rā.